Thank you. If it pleases the court, Mr. Messina, my name is Red Tripp, and I represent the appellant in this case, the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley, also known as UTRGV. This case involves an employee, the appellee, who was allegedly injured by her employer, UTRGV, and for which there is a dispute over whether or not she was in the course and scope of her employment at the time she was injured. Course and scope of employment is a component of the definition of compensability under the Texas Workers' Compensation Act, and to which the Texas Department of Insurance Division of Workers' Compensation has exclusive jurisdiction. Now, a brief recitation of the facts, I think, will highlight why the division has the exclusive jurisdiction to determine compensability. In this case, Ms. Oteka was a nursing professor at UTRGV, and on May 11th, 2019, there was a graduation ceremony. Ms. Oteka attended, she says, to support her students. She was in full graduation regalia, the robe and the cap. She greeted the students as they came in with other faculty who were also in full graduation regalia. She sat with faculty in a designated area in the auditorium, and then after the graduation, she, with the other faculty, led the students out of the area where they had the graduation. Now, after the graduation, while she was heading to her car as a pedestrian, walking through the parking area at the McAllen Convention Center where the graduation occurred, she was struck by a vehicle, a UTRG vehicle, a marked UTRG police car driven by a police officer who was patrolling the grounds during the graduation for UTRGV. Now, at the time this occurred, UTRGV was self-insured for purposes of workers' compensation. The facts in this case raise several possible doctrines that are exclusive to the Workers' Compensation Act.
But let me just clarify. You're not arguing that she was within the course and scope of her employment at the time of the injury, are you?
No.
Okay.
I am certainly not.
Okay.
That actual issue would require looking at the special mission exception, the dual purpose doctrine.
I understand. You were arguing so much about all the UTRGV process of the graduation that I thought maybe I was misinterpreting something, but thank you for clarifying that.
No, Your Honor. It's just that these concepts are complex, and the Division of Workers' Compensation has experience and expertise in understanding them. The legislature has given the Division of Workers' Compensation exclusive primary jurisdiction on issues of compensability under the Workers' Compensation Act. This book is the Workers' Compensation Act and the Administrative Rules. It's large. It's actually gotten larger over the years. It's complex law, and the legislature felt that a certain agency, the Division of Workers' Compensation, should have exclusive jurisdiction over those issues. The Supreme Court has consistently affirmed that whether a worker sustained a work-related injury falls directly under the division's exclusive primary jurisdiction. This is in the Henry v. Dillard case, which is cited in my brief, the Signs v. Fidelity, the American Motorists v. Foge, and appellate courts have also held that the division has exclusive jurisdiction over questions of compensability.
Counsel, my concern is the Mann case. That's our case out of this jurisdiction, and we're bound by our precedent, obviously. And so tell us, you know, wouldn't you think we'd have to overturn Mann to agree with you? And if so, or if not, why not?
I actually don't believe. I believe that Mann was correctly decided.
Okay.
The Mann case, very similar facts. We have a worker for Berry Contracting who was struck, and I believe in that case he may have been killed by a vehicle driven by another employee of Berry Contracting. However, the issue in Mann was not the exclusive jurisdiction of the division, but whether or not the exclusive remedy doctrine applied. Now, the 13th Court, this court, did request that the parties brief the issue of the division's exclusive jurisdiction. And upon that request, Berry Contracting argued that the division did have exclusive jurisdiction because the exclusive remedy defense depends upon course and scope, and the division has exclusive jurisdiction over compensability, a component which is course and scope. Mr. Mann conceded that if Berry Contracting had workers' compensation insurance coverage, quote, without a doubt, the trial court would not have original jurisdiction. However, the issue in Mann, which is not as clear from the decision, but it's very clear in the briefing, which I've attached to my brief in the appendix, is that there was a coverage issue. Mr. Mann was on a public street. He had checked in. There were two insurance policies by Berry Contracting for workers' comp, but one of them had to do with like them being on like the particular premises, and both insurance carriers said, "This we are not covering this case." Issues of coverage, of insurance coverage, are not within the exclusive jurisdiction of the Division of Workers' Compensation. And the Berry v. Mann case was an issue of whether or not the insurance coverage brought him under the course and scope. I don't believe that either party ever argued that somehow Mr. Mann was not working. It was the issue of whether or not he was in fact covered. If there is no workers' compensation insurance coverage, there is nothing for the Division of Workers' Compensation to do. So I believe that Berry v. Mann was correctly decided, and that the effect of Berry v. Mann does not actually apply to this case because the issues were very different. In this case, there are complex facts which the appellee goes through great lengths to argue. However, that fact issue is not before this court and should not have been before the trial court because the fact issue of compensability is within the exclusive jurisdiction of the Division of Workers' Compensation. Now, appellee Ms. Oteka has stated in her briefing that she did not inject herself into the workers' compensation system, that she did nothing to trigger the requirements of the Workers' Compensation Act. However, in the Workers' Compensation Act, under Section 406.034B, an employee has 5 days from the date that they are hired by an employer who has workers' compensation coverage to opt out of that coverage in writing. And if the employee does not opt out of that coverage prior to ever receiving any injuries, they cannot subsequently try to opt out of that coverage. And that's 406.035.
Kind of on that vein, I hate to interrupt you, but does it matter that they never offered any coverage until like 2.5 years later or something? I can't remember.
That's not exactly true because they had initially, when you look at the evidence, they had initially contacted her telling her, hey, this is a workers' compensation claim, call us back. She said, no, I don't need any relief from you. And under that vein, the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley said, okay, then we're just going to close this claim and not accept it if you don't want any relief from us. Subsequently, she then files a negligence, and it became obvious to UTRGV that, yes, she in fact did want relief. She just did not want it under the Workers' Compensation Act. It's also worth noting that when the claim was initially filed, it was in fact initially filed with the division. And this actually kind of aligns with the Inri Hellas case, which is out of the third court, which just came down about a month and a half ago, where that unfortunately was a death claim, but the beneficiaries, who were the parents of the deceased, did not want the claim under workers' compensation. They pursued the claim in negligence. And the third court basically said that the injured employee or the beneficiaries cannot sua sponte and of their own volition opt out of workers' compensation. This is insurance that the appellant has purchased for a purpose. If I get into a car wreck, I can't have the person who I wrecked into say, we don't want money from your insurance, we want it from you instead. There's a reason the University of Texas RGV purchased that insurance, and that's because both parties are benefited by the Workers' Compensation Act. An employee is benefited because it's no fault. So in this case, no one is saying that Ms. Oteka was at fault. However, this is not the only claim of hers that would be covered. It would cover any work-related claim she had. And under negligence, she would be obligated to prove negligence, but under workers' comp, she doesn't have to prove that anybody was negligent. Under the Workers' Compensation Act, there are no co-pays, and it is actually against the Workers' Compensation Act law for a provider to directly bill an injured worker. And they have immediate payment for any lost time. So if they say to UTRGV, hey, I'm losing time, I'm not going to work, and I'm losing a paycheck, within 7 days they start getting paid. By the same token, UTRGV, as the employer, also receives benefits. There's controlled medical costs under the medical fee guideline pursuant to the statute, as well as the reduced litigation costs, because there is this administrative process which tends to be much faster and much less expensive than litigation. So even though Ms. Oteka prefers not to use the workers' compensation coverage, she cannot simply sua sponte waive UTRGV's privileges under the Act. And in fact, even suing under the Tort Claims Act, as Ms. Oteka has done, Texas Civil Rights and Remedies Code 101.028 specifically states that a governmental unit keeps all of the privileges and immunities granted by the workers' compensation laws, even when sued in negligence. So in this case, the University of Texas, RGV, is self-insured for workers' compensation coverage. They have that coverage. Ms. Oteka was covered by that coverage. UTRGV has accepted that claim, and Ms. Oteka has not disputed that acceptance of the claim. And it's also worth pointing out, because I know in the Inri Halas case, the family actually ended up waiving their right to benefits under that claim because there was a one-year rule. In Ms. Oteka's case, there is a kind of a one-year rule that says that she must file a claim within a year of her injury or she waives it. However, under 406.004, if the insurance carrier has accepted the claim, she doesn't have to file the claim. It's already been accepted.
Let me ask you that question. Are you, in answering Justice Longoria's question about the two-year, that you all said, why don't you do it and all that? Well, can UTRGV or its carrier invoke the administrative process? I mean, it's not just up to the plaintiff's obligation. It's not just the plaintiff's obligation. If y'all felt this was a workers' comp case, you know, like in the Hellas case and the Tyler Asphalt case, they actually, you know, in that case, the defendants in those cases invoked the administrative process. So if y'all thought it was a workers' comp case, why not do it from the onset?
Okay, so Your Honor, this claim has been accepted, so there are no disputes on the claim. So it really would be up to Ms. Oteka to dispute the claim. And I would also state that I have worked in workers' compensation for over 30 years, and in my experience, it is extremely difficult to get the division to make a ruling on an issue that is not being disputed. In the past, we have tried, you know, with other clients to raise issues concerning whether or not maybe a neck injury extends to the low back, and they say, well, if the injured worker isn't saying it extends to the low back, we're not even going to hear that issue. So in this case, Ms. Oteka has never told the division that she refuses. She has never disputed the claim with the division, because if she had disputed the claim with the division, I think it would be easier for to actually get the hearing and pursue the division's exclusive jurisdiction and determination on compensability.
Okay, along those lines, there's a lot of authority that discusses abatement as a remedy. Why isn't it appropriate here as opposed to a dismissal?
Well, Your Honor, yes, other cases parties have filed protectively. In this case, Ms. Oteka has actually never requested an abatement. So if Ms. Oteka requested an abatement, that is certainly something that the court could grant. And if there are no further questions, I'll just reserve. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, may it please the court, counsel. I actually prepared, I'm excited to be here. I'm typically a trial attorney, and I get to do witnesses and jury selection and do depositions and things like that with the eye of hoping I get it right. And sometimes I find myself here. And in this case, I truly believe that it was prepared and presented correctly under the law as we understand it to be, with the contested issues that were presented at the pleading stage of this case. And notably, I think we're making a very simple case complicated. I think the UTRGV is trying to overcomplicate what now it may even be more simple from what I'm hearing today, because from the outset, it was pled that the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation was an affirmative defense that they were entitled to. This is already in a tough area of law where the damages are capped for Ms. Soteca to bring her claims and prosecutor claims and prevail. She, if this were a different commercial defendant or things like that, we're having a whole different conversation, but she deserves the applicable law to be applied to her case. And so in this case, they pled that as an exclusive remedy that bars her from her claims. So case strategy and development of evidence in this case was geared towards that. And today is the first time I've heard that there's apparently it's not contested that she was not in the course and scope of employment, because UTRGV's pleaded the jurisdiction sure said she was, and their brief in this case sure said she was.
Counsel, on page 24 of your brief, you state that the appellant is contractually estopped from asserting there is no jurisdiction. What authority do you have in support of the proposition that a party can waive or confer jurisdiction?
I think that I didn't cite any law on that, and I think that just thinking about general estoppel and fairness, the issue that I put before the court is, would the same arguments be made had they not substituted in as a defendant in this case? It was more speculative, I'd say, than law that I'm citing when I raised that, but to me, it does cause a little concern that you could substitute in and then assert this remedy, because then they wouldn't. What if they kept it as the officer, and then he would not be her employer in that situation? And I could be wrong. I will admit, could be wrong with that statement when we made that. And I don't think that's what this case is about, though. No part of Rita Oteca's claims requires the trial court to determine whether or not she is eligible for workers' compensation benefits. This court has found repeatedly that the exclusive remedy or jurisdiction over affirmative defenses rests with the trial court. And I'm trying to give an outline of how deep I can go into any of these issues, but I have a couple bullet points of some of the things I think that we should look at. The evidence gathered in the discovery in this case, which is part of the record, which is part of the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment that she was not in the course and scope of employment, was well thought out and well developed. The requirements of when to go to, what her job duties were, when it would occur, what's voluntary, what's not, where it occurred, in this case is important. It's back to real estate. If the defined premises is not where it occurred, then that's not an area controlled by her employer, and that matters for the access doctrine, or what I've called the coming and going rule. And I think that since the court's making a de novo review of this evidence, you'll see by looking at some of these admissions even made by her supervisor that they did not prove any of the exceptions to the coming and going rule, which is the general default rule in Texas of, are you at work or are you not? But today,
well,
I guess I'm hearing.
Counsel, they've already conceded, and no. Looking at the brief, it appears to me that they're really not arguing that she's within the course and scope of employment at the time of the injury. But what I think what they're contending is that the trial court cannot assess the course and scope issue unless it is first presented to DWC. So if that's the case, that's why I go back to the abatement issue. If we find that you're required to exhaust your administrative remedies, you know, how can you amend your pleadings to address the exhaustion issue? And if abatement is an option in the case, you know, we can just abate it and you exhaust your, you know, you just pursue your exhaustion issue and then come back, you know, and I mean, it just seems to me you keep arguing course and scope, but they're saying, you know, they're saying they're not arguing course and scope. They just said you haven't exhausted your remedies.
I sure would hope that that's if this court were inclined to buy this argument that the compensability has to be evaluated by the division for the claims, how she has them framed, which I dispute. Yeah. If the court were to be swayed by that, and I do agree that would be changing some of the rulings that this court has made, yes, abatement is the way to go with that, because what we have is 33 days after the incident, we have a denial of compensability and refusal to pay benefits letter that's presented to her. It's long before she filed her lawsuit. And that's based on, they didn't say, would you like to open a workers' compensation claim? They said your employer has reported an incident that may have involved being on the job or work-related. Her response, which she responded when they asked her, was, I plan on pursuing this through my private medical healthcare coverage. They paper her up very clearly, and this is all in the record and cited by actually UTRGV in their plea to the jurisdiction. I think it's Exhibit 11 and onward, 11 and 12 perhaps, that, okay, well then you don't have workers' compensation benefits. Had their message been different at that time, you know, the whole scenario, so this raises kind of how I was going to conclude, but I'm happy to bring it up now, is it's a chilling effect of when is the claimant supposed to know that this is even an issue on the table? Fast forward a little bit, she filed her case. They say you're in the course and scope of employment, or workers' compensation is your exclusive benefit, which requires a finding of course and scope. And it's only after we filed and set our motion for summary judgment saying, actually, as a matter of law, she's not course and scope of employment, that there's this letter that we received from the adjuster again saying, well, wait a minute, we've reevaluated it and we're going to open up a claim and it's awarded. I'll point out, and this is all in the record because those are all in, I think, Exhibit 11 and 12 of UTRGV's put in the jurisdiction, and they're worth looking at. You know, on one of them, the claim numbers are redacted, but on the other one, you can see the claim number. I don't know. I don't know if they're the same or not. I don't know if they reopened a claim or if they opened a new claim. There's just some things in there that you can't tell what that even means. Again, I'm getting in the weeds, I realize, on the record, but this also goes back to, well, what's a de novo review of the court's denial of UTRGV's plea to the jurisdiction? And evidentiary-wise, it was weak. There were no affidavits. There was no business record affidavits. It was just letters attached that we objected to. And we never got a ruling. But let's presume the objections were overruled, even if we presume that. We can certainly determine that the court assigned the proper weight and credibility to that evidence that UTRG presented to try to prove, as a matter of law, that there's no subject matter jurisdiction for the court to oversee the applicability of the affirmative defense of exclusive remedy. And I thought that we actually proved the other way in that case. Of course, we disagree, and I don't think we got a ruling on the summary judgments in this case. But
Counselor, are you familiar with our Mann case? I assume. I hope you are.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. She seems to think that it's not applicable and that basically it just can be distinguished from this case. Do you agree with her?
I do not. I think that I'm pulling up my notes on the Mann case. I tried to summarize what I believe that holding was, and it was that the trial court has subject matter jurisdiction of the exclusive remedy defense, and no part of the claims in that case by the plaintiff required the plaintiff to be eligible for workers' compensation benefits. And I'll point out just factually, in that case, Mr. Mann was actually clocked in. He had already clocked in for work and then was injured crossing a street, I guess in the same complex and area where work was. Factually, if this court found in that case, well, that's not, the issues brought before the court aren't workers' compensation related. To the extent Ms. Oteka was even on the clock ever on a Saturday commencement to support her students, but just even conceding that that was on the clock, let's call it, her leaving the premises, the defined leased premises, and going out to the to her car in a non-designated area of parking cuts that off. And I think that, it, I know I'm getting back to course and scope of employment, but factually, as to man, that's a big distinction to me, that it's even closer to the purview of the trial court. And I think this court in the city of Corpus Christi versus Mueller, it was the same, it was actually similar in that it was an evaluation of the coming and going rule. And the lady in that case was injured. And the question was, well, she parked her car and was on her way to work. And without evidence proven by her employer that the implicit or explicit requirements of area to park and such, then the trial court still has subject matter jurisdiction to review that for their status in that situation, to review the affirmative defense that's been asserted. To answer your question, I do not agree that it doesn't apply in this case. I think the court got it right. And I think a lot of the other cases that are cited by UTRGV, they deal with folks who had filed claims, workers' compensation claims. And maybe during that process, they would file another case too. There would be abatements. There would be who has priority or jurisdiction to resolve the compensability issue, and then how it would get appealed to the trial court. We just don't have that in this case.
Well, there is a case that sort of that's similar in that there's no pending administrative proceedings. It's out of San Antonio. It's the Berales or Berales. I guess it's a correct pronunciation. How do you distinguish that case?
I might be getting it confused with the Morales case, but
I don't know if I have the site.
It's 562 South of 3rd.
Yes, I have a copy of it actually right here. I'm just trying to find my notes on it. I remember that case. I think it's, wasn't that, that's a case that had, she was absolutely working. She was a maid or a housekeeper at a hotel and was sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. And her attorneys and she attempted to raise one of the exceptions of cessation of course of scope for private, I forget what it's called, the term private, personal animosity exception. And so I think just factually speaking, you know, at least in that case, we're talking about somebody who was in the building working. And it's a lot different than this case. And so in that situation, I think that the compensability issue and whether or not she was course and scope, yeah, the commission or division has the right to review that and make a determination. But I realize I'm going to be pressed on time, but some of the questions I think that this poses though is, so when would Ms. Oteka have asserted these rights that she has to assert through the division? Was it at a time she thought, well, I don't need to pursue it that way, I have personal health insurance? Was it at a time that they said, well, since you're doing that, we're closing your claim, it's denied? Was it at a time that they pled the exclusive remedy of that? Was it at the time that the summary judgment was filed and set by her attorneys? And what all that comes down to is, are we shifting the burden to the plaintiff to disprove an affirmative defense in a way by going through the Division of Workers' Comp, when in fact the facts show she wasn't working, and now it's not even contested that she wasn't working. Which it has been until today, from everything I've read, and I could be wrong, but I think that's how it's played out. And it's a moving target. And so I think we go back to Mann and back to Mueller, and I don't see why this court would change its course. And the most recent case that was brought up by counsel in the Hellis case had two underlying cases, and it had to do with lifting an abatement and whether or not the trial court had the power to do that while a determination was being made. I mean, just factually speaking, it's so different than this case. We're talking about the exclusive remedy affirmative defense. And again, as argued, it makes it really difficult for the law practitioner to figure out, well, I mean, so do we have to evaluate all of our cases to see if someone you sue may assert that you were in that the workers' compensation division should evaluate compensability when you're not seeking it? And no part of your claim relates to that. A lot of these cases that are cited by UTRGV deal with the compensability issue being appealed or evaluated, that they initiated something, but that just didn't happen in this case.
So you think that, I guess, the important issue here, one of the important issues is what I asked about, and that is, and I think Justice Longoria asked about the time, the fact that they waited 2 years or, you know, I guess after she'd already sort of started her personal injury case, that they came forward and they said, you should have done it. You know, the fact that they could have done it too, and chose not to, and sort of allowed the plaintiff in this case to move forward through the courts rather than tire into the workers' comp.
They waited longer than that. I mean, they didn't wait till she filed the lawsuit. They waited. We actually don't know when they opened it up again or attempted to open it up again, but what we do know is it's not that they sat back and didn't do anything. They actually closed it out. They closed out and said there's not a claim. And in fact, in the record, I think it's 260 of the record, it's Exhibit 11 and 12 of their plea to the jurisdiction. The quote was, in addition, having a full and clear understanding of your rights and available insurance coverage, you made an informed choice to seek treatment under your personal group health insurance. This is called an, quote, election of remedies, end quote, which means your right to seek benefits under workers' compensation insurance at a later date is not allowed. That's what they notified her of on June 14th, 2019. Her accident was on May 11th, 2019. It's closed. Mm-hmm. And the evidence in the record that they put in the evidence is there. So then the question is, well, then, so where's she supposed to go? What is she supposed to do? Argue it? Well, no, she doesn't think she's at work. She filed a lawsuit. And again, like I said, an already very challenging scenario with damage caps already in place. And so, look, we're trying to do the best we can for this client under the situation of how we found her. And as pled, the exclusive remedy of the affirmative defense is what we did discovery on. It's what we developed. It's what we actually felt like we could win on a summary judgment on. And now, turns out, I guess we were right. But now we're dealing with, like I said, a simple case turned complicated, I believe. And I'm sorry if I'm not as artful, I guess, in some of the cases and things that deal with that. But I'm like, but wait a minute. Let's go back to Mann, and let's go back to how this court has already ruled on that, and think about what overruling that would mean. And the case you just mentioned, the Hellis case, the issue in that was actually, I wrote down my notes, they were disputing if he was an employee or not. We don't have that dispute. He had applied and was an employee of three different outfits, it's called construction companies, and so they were all pointing at each other. Well, you're independent contractor, you're employee. So it's a little bit different factually than what we have here. There was also no dispute that was course and scope. I guess we don't anymore. And there was also abatement involved. And so I would say as a very much a backup plan, I think the trial court got it right in this case when they denied UTRGV's put in jurisdiction. I think they totally got it right. However, if anything, rather than saying they didn't have jurisdiction to do that, I would think an abatement, I mean, this is very much a backup request, but abatement to solidify where we already are that there's no workers' compensation benefits is the way to go. And I hope we don't go do that. But thank you for your time, and I'm out of time.
This is a simple case that has been made complicated. The Division of Workers' Compensation has exclusive primary jurisdiction to make determinations of compensability. We are not talking about exclusive remedy. And despite Appellee's argument, UTRGV's appeal does not seek adjudication of the exclusive remedy doctrine, while the exclusive remedy affirmative defense was raised in the answer, which was the proper place to raise that affirmative defense. However, subsequent, there was the plea to the jurisdiction raised, which basically said, we don't get to the exclusive remedy determination on the facts until the division makes a determination on compensability. Moreover, just for clarification, the University of Texas is not saying Ms. Oteka was not in the course and scope of her employment. The University of Texas believes that she was. However, that is a factual question that is left up to the Division of Workers' Compensation, not this court, not the trial court, because the Division of Workers' Compensation has exclusive jurisdiction over that factual issue. And the viability of Ms. Oteka's negligence claim is wholly dependent on the outcome of the division's determination, because under Texas Labor Code 406.034A, an employee waives the right of an action at common law or under statute to recover damages for personal injuries that are sustained in the course and scope of her employment. So if the division determines that her injuries were sustained in the course and scope of her employment, she has waived her right to sue UT in negligence. And for that reason, this case needs to go before the Division of Workers' Compensation, who has the exclusive primary jurisdiction to make the determination and to go through the administrative process before it is ripe for judicial review. And moreover, there seems to be some confusion in Rehellas about when a claim exists. However, Texas Labor Code 409.001, pretty much through 409.008, discuss when a claim exists. And a claim does not only exist when an injured employee makes a claim. In fact, a claim exists as soon as an employer knows that there is an injury that is in the course and scope of employment. And under 409.021, an employee is obligated to pay on that claim within 7 days or deny it. So as soon as an employer has knowledge of a workers' compensation claim, that is the claim. The claim isn't a piece of paper that Ms. Oteka says, I want to pursue these insurance benefits under this insurance policy that UTRGV has purchased in order to protect itself. The claim exists as soon as the employer and the insurance carrier know that there's a claim. And while it was, I'm going to be honest, a little inartful, the employer, UTRGV, did reach out to Ms. Oteka to let her know that this was potentially a workers' compensation claim and they needed to talk to her about it. She refused to talk to them about it. She refused to give them any information and said, no, I'm not going to pursue these benefits. So they said, okay, well, we'll deny the claim. And it was.
But how about this letter that he refers to where the file was closed, where they basically say, because you sought medical attention through your health insurance carrier, you know, you do not have a claim under workers' comp, or words to that. I mean, I don't have the document in front of me, obviously, but.
Well, I mean, yeah, well, that was because she had made the decision that she wasn't going to seek any benefits, and there, quite frankly, UTRGV sent that letter to protect itself. She was not making a claim against them. She was not filing her medical with them. She did not file any lost time with them. I believe she actually had a second job, which she would have been entitled to payment from the University of Texas RGV for that second employment. In order for the University of Texas RGV to not pay on her claim, they had to deny it. in order to protect themselves.
But they, but wasn't she already suing them? They had notice of a lawsuit, didn't they?
No, not at that time. That was about a month and a half after the injury, if I recall correctly. Okay. I believe it was, I'm going to guess the date, but it was like June 19th, and the injury occurred on May 11th.
So there was no lawsuit?
Not at that time, no. And there is a case, and I could not find it, but there is another case where the court basically stated that because a claim was initially denied, does not waive out of workers' compensation. That isn't the end all be all to it. That if there is an issue of compensability, that falls within the exclusive jurisdiction.
Is that cited in your brief?
I believe that it is, and I'm going to try. I'll try to find it.
And if it isn't, you know, feel free to supplement that with the letter.
And I am out of time, but I would like to thank the court for the opportunity to argue in front of you. And thank you very much.
Case will be under submission. Thank you both for coming.